Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game. Or, if you prefer it Sky Sports transfer window style-y, wait a minute, I'm hearing news of football finance pod just in. This could be massive. Let's go to Kevin Day and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire, who will check their phones and then tell us they have no further details at this time. Kieran, how is your transfer window? Were there some huge moves in the Vineyard near the south coast?
I think the Baroness has booked herself a season ticket at the Vineyard. So, yes, she seems to be doing very well. We've shipped quite a few players out on loan. We've got 19 players out on loan, which is nice. Crazy. Who's going to play for us in the Carabao Cup? Yeah, which unheard players, which I normally go along to the Carabao Cup matches for, to go, who's he? How long has he been with us? Oh, he's out on loan now, so yeah. No idea what's going on.
It could be worse, Kieran. Your under-23s could be getting spanked by Sutton in the Papa John's, or whatever it's called. Later in this episode, we will hear from Colin Kavanagh of the Rochdale Supporters Trust to get his view on the failed hostile takeover attempt on the club. But first, breaking news. Kieran, is there a possible different model to the transfer window, by the way? Does the transfer window work?
It works in the sense that it's potentially the least bad option, because there were rumours a few years ago of a legal challenge to the idea of having player transfers at all, because it could be argued that it didn't allow freedom of movement of labour, which is one of the core EU rules. So this was brought in as a sort of, you know, a sap to the rule makers. But, you know, you and I are both old enough to remember the days pre the transfer window, when you could sign any player at any time. And to a certain extent, you know, that smoothed out the costs. It didn't mean that you have this this crazy runaround. Or, you know, there are sort of radical alternatives, such as some form of a draft system, or to one of the proposals under the Super League franchise was that you could not transfer players from one Super League club to another. And the aim there was to keep wages down, because it meant that, you know, players couldn't go from Manchester United to Real Madrid for more money. So yeah, that was the driving force, as was proven to be everything to do with Super League. But we could move on to something more radical, but I think it's unlikely.
I couldn't stop myself last night, Kieran. I had the house to myself, so I was doing what I usually do and perusing BBC 4. No, Kieran, not that, for the love of God. You are so childish. I was watching a documentary on BBC 4, Kieran, which is how I tend to pass the time of an evening. But I couldn't stop myself from flicking across to Sky Sports. And I particularly enjoyed their dilemma, because they were obviously all over Cristiano Ronaldo. But then a huge story came in that they couldn't take their eyes off. PSG turned down €225 million, around £189 million, for a player who will leave for nothing in a few months. I mean, that's a start. I mean, I know PSG are rich, Kieran, but that they've basically taken a €225 million hit there, haven't they?
Yes, because it's almost certain that Kylian Mbappe will move next summer for nothing. But in the Price of Football book, we say that owning a football club. What are the motives for it? And I think it was love, profit, vanity, and insanity. And I think we've got vanity and insanity expressed in terms of that particular potential deal, in the sense that Florentino Perez, who, again, part of Super League, the man that believes that by giving more money to billionaires, you're going to save European football, he wants Kylian Mbappe to remind people that Real Madrid are the preeminent football club in the world in his eyes, and therefore they can sign anybody that they want. Equally, you could regard it as insanity for PSG to reject the bid, given that it is, as you rightly point out, they're going to lose the thick end of 200 million over the course of the next year. But from their perspective, remember, they are owned by the Qatari Sports Institute or Sports Investment Fund. And of course, we have the 2022 World Cup taking place in Qatar. And what better way of leading up to that would be to have PSG win the Champions League, and PSG with its close links to Qatar. So they were in a position to reject it. But the fact that a club can reject a 200 million offer is indicative of the unusual finances we see in certain club ownership models. Mm-hmm.
I think my favourite moment on Sky Sports is when they cut to a clip of Mbappe with the French national team, and one of the coaches says something to him, and the guy says, "We believe this is the moment where Mbappe learns he's not going to Madrid." And Mbappe, how they infer that, I don't know. But then Mbappe turns around and does some keepy uppies, and they go, "He doesn't seem too concerned about having his own." So my guess, I would infer from that the coach had actually said to him, "Would you do some keepy uppies?"
Very probably.
It's Sky really are astonishing on Sky. It's I almost think they're parodying themselves sometimes.
Well, yes, because they had Sam Allardyce on last night and Paul Merson, and Sam Allardyce was peddling the myth. And we know that it is a myth that shirt sales are going to pay for Cristiano Ronaldo's wages 10 times over, Kevin, 10 times over. So that's an awful lot of shirts, given that they make £4 a shirt in terms of profit.
Yeah, it must be very frustrating for Sam Allardyce not to be involved. I imagine he played some sort of fantasy football yesterday where he signed 4 31-year-olds just for old time's sake. And on the subject of transfers, Kieran, and big money, FIFA this week released some numbers that they'd crunched, because it's not only you that crunches numbers, Kieran. FIFA have analysed 10 years of the international transfer market and found that £48.5 billion was spent in that 10 years, and a Premier League club spent most of it.
Well, yes.
And I've got a name written down, Kieran, and I'm going to ask you what that name is and see if it's the name I've got written down.
I'm going for Manchester City, Kevin.
Ah, damn, really? I've written them all down, Kieran. Basically, I've written six clubs down. I went Chelsea, but okay, but. Oh, yes, £48.5 billion spent on human beings in 10 years, Kieran. That's a lot of money, isn't it?
It is a lot. It was also interesting. If anybody wants to go and read that report, by the way, it's on the FIFA website. It's available for free. You can download it. £3.5 billion went to agents during the same period, which
what? Also,
3.5, that's a lot of zeros on the end of those deals. Which is just an incredible amount of money, and it does probably make you realise just why so many people are keen to become agents in an industry where you need no qualifications, and there's not the equivalent tradespeople.com or whatever these places call themselves, anybody can be an agent. It'll just cost you a £500 check to the FA, and away you go. So the biggest spenders were Manchester City, followed by Chelsea. So you did actually have effectively the top two there. You are effectively you could be the Doris Stokes of football finance.
Good luck with that reference. Let's pause here to do a footnote to explain to younger people. Doris Stokes was a famous psychic medium who got in touch with dead people in the 70s. Basically, that's past for entertainment when we were kids, basically. There's a couple of our older readers I know will chuckle at that.
Yes. So, yeah, so this show, it was an interesting report in the sense that it showed where the players were coming from, and the biggest exporters of football players are from Brazil, which I think is, you know, I don't think it's a hugely surprising that. But if there's been 40 odd billion spent, you know, the way to think of it, it is a money go round, and therefore 40 odd billion must have been received by other clubs. Mm. So it is a way of circulating money around the game, but it's also indicative that just how big the football market is. And I think I may have got this wrong, that the FIFA report just dealt with international transfers.
Yes, it did.
That would exclude the likes of Jack Grealish going from Manchester, going from Villa to Manchester City, and so on. So you throw those in, and the numbers would have been even more crazy.
Mm. And of course, in the 70s, this is by way of making young people realise how lucky they are. If Doris Stokes wasn't entertainment enough, we also had Jeanette Charles, whose USP was she looked like the Queen.
Yes.
Basically, she looked like the Queen, so she was turned up in every sketch show going, I don't know if you know the answer to this question, Kieran, but what is the reason for the report? Was this by way of FIFA saying there's been too much money spent, or is this a celebration of how much money was spent? What's the point of the timing of this report?
Well, to be fair to FIFA, they do put out an annual report in a similar nature, and because this covered the decade, so it covered the teenies, taking us up to 11 to 20. So that was the basis of the report, and it would allow them to compare to the previous decade and. We can all sort of stroke our chins and say the world's gone to hell in the handcart. Look at these numbers.
Yeah, two stories now concerning clubs that have been with us on this pod since day one, Kieran, for good or ill. The first is that a group of Bury supporters have submitted a bid to buy back the club and Gig Lane. What sort of money are we looking here?
Well, this is, I believe, a potential bid. Now, we have to be a little bit cautious here because I read this story in the Bury Times, and I then went to the comment section because you know what it's like in local newspapers. You normally get, if you get one or two comments, you're lucky, but there was an awful lot on this particular story. And the terrible thing about Bury is not only was the club destroyed by Stuart Day and Steve Dale, but since then we've ended up with a form of civil war. We've got AFC Bury, who have started off again. They've nearly 1,500 people attend their last home match, which for the 10th tier of football is absolutely incredible. The other faction of the Bury support base, Forever Bury, who have created something called Established 1885, they say that there is an anonymous benefactor. So they're not saying how much is being bid. They are going down the Gig Lane as a community asset route, which is grand. I'm all in favour of that. And they've said they've got the backing of the two local MPs. Now, I've looked at the comments of the two local MPs, which appeared to be, wouldn't it be great if Bury could once again play at Gig Lane? So it's not exactly backing this group or criticising the other group, but it's very depressing. I mean, I attended some of the meetings at Bury Town Hall when the club was effectively being destroyed from the boardroom, and it was clear then that the fans weren't getting on with each other, and people, I think the politest way to say, they passionately disagreed with each other, but things were getting very very aggressive, and this has continued. in an ideal world, there's going to be one Bury Football Club, and in an ideal world, that's going to be playing at Gig Lane. Now what it's named is to a large extent an irrelevance. Yeah, we've got AFC Wimbledon playing at Plough Lane these days, and everybody seems happy with that. So people need to offer olive branches to each other and realise that they've actually got a common aim. Set egos aside, because the otherwise Steve Dale and his cronies will outmaneuver them.
Well, that's the one thing. It's beyond depressing here, and it's heartbreaking, because the one consolation when this happens, a la Wimbledon, is that a club goes out of business or a club's in trouble, and it unites everybody in the community and the football club together. And the opposite has happened here, and you can't help feeling that somewhere the dread hand of Steve Dale is still involved in all this. And it's just, it's a story I really want to get resolved as quickly as possible. But it's a terrible thing to observe, to be honest, Kieran, isn't it? And the other club, of course, and it's been 3 weeks, Kieran, so yes. I've missed them. But Derby County are moving closer to resolving their bitter row with the EFL, which is good news for all concerned, except, Kieran, of course, us. Because I don't know what there have been some weeks, Kieran, where if we didn't have Derby, we didn't have a pod. Yes. Basically, so we're going to have to interview somebody. There's no Derby news. But this is clearly good news at last for Derby County fans. Crikey! Really? How could Kieran? How can the words "moving closer to resolving their bitter row" not be good news?
Well. The EFL are under pressure. This is a report in the Telegraph. Are under pressure to give Derby County a 9-point deduction plus 3 further points suspended, with regards to their ongoing dispute over Derby County's amortisation policy. And the reason why I think we've moved one step forward in that. In the sense that Derby were given a deadline, because it itself got pushed back, of the 24th of August, in which to submit their accounts, revised accounts for 2016-18. So we assume that that's done. They still haven't done that. They've still not published anything for 2019 and 2020. So they've chosen deliberately to break company law in taking that approach for whatever reasons. And you know, I don't think breaking law can be condoned. When we had our friend Nick DeMarco on the show, he said to us. He would always advise clients to go through the mediation rather than prosecution route. I'm sure that he's had his discussions with Derby. It's not in the EFL's interests to have another lengthy scenario of having to make charges, then having to put a committee together, then data and evidence having to be submitted, then people go away and make a decision. Because if this ends up being resolved via a prosecution charge, we could be talking next March or April before that's resolved. That's towards the end of the season. That completely distorts the table just before the end of the season. So I believe the parties are being encouraged to resolve their differences, but the EFL is being monitored itself by the other clubs in the Championship, whose views with regards to Derby's approach to the way that they value players, I think, is fairly hostile. If the EFL says, okay, we'll go along with the approach, then they'll be seen as being soft on the issue, which will encourage others to use creative accounting. And believe me, there's plenty of other creative accounting methods that can be used. So I hope that the two parties can get together. It's going to help Mel Morris, the club owner, because would you buy a football club in the knowledge of a potential 12-point deduction hanging over the head? That has an implications in terms of the value of the club, because that would increase the chances of them spending 22, 23 in League One. So there's some progress. I think the accounts have been submitted. Where we're going to go from there, heaven only knows.
Kieran, you know I would buy a club if it had a 12-point deduction hanging over it, because I'm an idiot when it comes to money. That's what I'm doing in this pod. I'll buy it. Yeah, great. I own a football club. Yeah, brilliant. Can I change the kit? Yay, great. And it's nice to hear Kieran right at the start of that lengthy explanation. How lovely to hear a Maguire encouraging people not to break the law. That's yeah. No wonder you're the black sheep of that family,
Kieran. Absolutely.
This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by The Price of Football online course, hosted by our very own Kieran Maguire. Kieran, tell us more.
Well, Kevin, it's some friends of mine who couldn't afford the Swiss Ramble. So therefore, they decided instead to create the Price of Football course. So it's a 6-week online course starting on the 20th of September. And it's been designed for anybody who wants to potentially get a career in the football industry through a combination of quality education, but also networking. It's really important that you get to know people in the industry because it is a small industry. So it includes 6 hours of weekly study material and a 90-minute mentoring session every week on topics like governing bodies, clubs and investors. I might manage to sneak a bit about amortization in about it as well. So they've asked me to be one of the tutors. So you will see me, or perhaps hear me, or failing that, perhaps they'll see and hear Finlay. And you'll also get the option to attend the World Football Summit in Madrid, though I suspect that will be virtually.
It sounds wonderful, Kieran. It does sound genuinely interesting and a very good way to launch your career. I also like the fact that you're more likely to be tutored by Finlay than you are by me. if you are listening to this and you'd like to launch your career in the football industry with Kieran, and who better, let's face it, to help launch your career in the football industry, head to www.sportstalentnetwork.com for more information.
And I believe you can get an early bird 50% discount, which is still available. So if you go to www.sportstalentnetwork.com for more info, good luck.
Now, Kieran, I was listening to a very fine new podcast this week called The Famous Sloping Pitch, made by two friends of mine, Nick Hancock and Chris England, which is essentially two middle-aged men wanging away about football but without the financial element. So no competition at all. But Chris is a massive Oldham fan, so he'll be interested in the fact that a director of Oldham has made an impassioned plea, shall we say?
Yes, he's asked for fans to not get as upset, because there's been a number of protests taking place at Oldham. Yeah, we're only just into the start of September. Well, we've already had a pitch invasion, and then at another match there was, and I absolutely love this. This is what I think so great about football fans. There was an invasion of the tennis balls, where the fans just lobbed loads and loads of tennis balls on the pitch, and it was abandoned effectively for 5 minutes. And this is in protest against the way that the club has been run by Abdullah Lemsagam, who is a former agent who is now the club owner. Oldham are presently 23rd in League Two. Now, you and I are both, we're old enough to remember, Oldham getting to the FA Cup semi-final, being in the top division, Frankie Bum scoring goals for fun, and Andy Ritchie and so on. They used to be an absolute delight to watch in the first season of the Premier League.
I'm going to have to contradict you there, Kieran, considering they relegated us in that first season of the Premier League. So for some of us, Kieran, they weren't such a delight to watch. But yes, I understand. Yeah, I see your point.
Right, yeah. Also, as anybody that's ever been to regular away matches, no matter what the weather is, it's always, I think the technical term is, fucking freezing at always. Boundary Park. It's its own microclimate. In terms of the place, but it's still a proper old school football ground with a proper old school away end as well, where you would be you would be you against the elements. So I had a look at their accounts, and their most recent accounts. I've got my klaxons going off. They're unaudited. They're abridged, so we don't know too much about them. They've got liabilities of £5 million, which is considerable given the size of the club. And then I did go into what little small print I could find, and it said in the notes there's some form of tax investigation, which could involve up to £920,000 of additional tax having to be paid. So you put all that together, along with the fact that the only club beneath them in League Two is Sutton United, who already have a game in hand and have, of course, been unable to play any home games because of this somewhat harsh approach of forcing them to rip up the pitch. So the club's in a pickle. The fans are unhappy. I was approached by an Oldham fan group and they said, would I cast an eye over the accounts, and they pitched that to the club. And the club said, we've not heard of him. He's an accountant. He could be a turf accountant for all we know. So we won't have him near us. And I would have just gone in and looked at it from a neutral perspective. As I try to be as objective as possible. So it doesn't look great. You can understand the tensions of the fans, and once again, we're talking about issues in the northwest of England. There's too much that has gone on. Wigan, Macclesfield, now Oldham, Bury. We've just been talking about Rochdale. It's a concerning area. And where the club goes from here, because once that relationship between fan base and owners breaks down, especially for smaller clubs, it's very difficult to repair.
Yeah, it's all very well making impassioned pleas as a director, but if you don't want fans on the pitch, don't stuff up their club. And also, I think legally, Guy always likes to say, point out that legally the accounts don't have to be audited, do they?
No, they don't. Under normal circumstances, I would say it's an unnecessary cost for a business of that size. But I took a look at the 2018 accounts, which was in the first year of ownership, I think, of the Mr. Lemsagam. And whether you audit accounts or not, there's some things which you should be able to get right. The one thing you should be able to get right is how much money you've got in your bank account. Because what you do is you go online, you say, that's how much money I've got in my bank account. But Oldham published their accounts twice that year, and in the first time they published them, their bank balance was £261,000, and then they republished them a few months later, and it was down to six. The Baroness let loose in John Lewis can do an awful lot of damage to my bank account on an afternoon. But even so, that's a big correction on something which should be correct in the first place.
You say you can go online to check your account, Kieran. You can also have a little piece of paper that's folded up about 86 times in your wallet and write it down. Every time I go online to check the bank account, I do it with one eye, because I'm desperately hoping it matches the figure I've got written down on my little piece of paper. It rarely does, but there you are. I'm going to stick my neck out here, Kieran, and suggest that if there is a ground colder than Oldham, it's Carlisle. you should be able to wear a jacket and T-shirt to an away game in September, Kieran, but, it's a long way away. And their supporters trust, Carlisle Supporters Trust, are awaiting the outcome of several meetings, aren't they?
Yes, Carlisle did produce their accounts recently, and I think I gave them 6 stars out of 5. They were very comprehensive. Yeah. So the people at the club, have been, I think, pretty transparent. The issue in relation to Carlisle United is that the club borrowed from a company called Edinburgh Woolen Mill, And it borrowed over £2 million. And Edinburgh Woolen Mill, partly due to the pandemic, I suspect significantly due to the pandemic, have gone into administration. So where we stand in respect of that debt, you know, and the people behind Edinburgh Woolen Mill say, we're not going to call it in, but the future of Carlisle, how it's going to be funded, is there going to be some form of succession plan? There seems to be a lot of uncertainty here. And I think Carlisle United is another example of a club that have got a supporters trust who have got their head screwed on. You know, as we've seen with the interview with Rochdale and also our friends at Swindon, is football fans are not as stupid as they are made out to be by vast sections of the community, including quite often directors of football clubs. Mm. So the Carlisle Supporters Trust does seem to be taking this in a very measured way, but it is trying to ask, I think, the right questions in terms of, you know, where is the club going from a financial perspective? Does it need further funding? If so, where's that likely to come from? But it creates uncertainty. And you know, the one thing that we like about football clubs is a degree of certainty, not on the pitch, because we all know it's normally going to be some form of a basket case, but off the pitch, you like to know the fact that, your club's in good hands. And whilst I've praised certainly the board of Carlisle in the way that they've put out information, I think there's an opportunity to do a bit more as well.
It's a short and rather scenic trip from Carlisle across the border to Scotland for our next two stories. And firstly, Rangers have announced how much their fan share has made.
Yes, we had John Bennett from the Rangers board of directors on the show a few months ago, and what they had decided to do was, on the back of winning the premiership for the 55th title, they wanted to democratize the share base, the fan base. So they offered shares for 25 pence each. They were looking to raise 6.75 million on the back of this, which I thought at the time was quite ambitious. But they've managed to get 5,000 new investors from 44 different countries. And I think this is indicative of Rangers, and it has to be said, Celtic, both having, you know, a very global fan base who have put in £4.5 million. And you've got to admire those fans, because they're not going to get a dividend in all probability. They're not going to make a profit on those shares in all probability, but they do it out of a love for the club that means so much to them. So yes, they didn't, you know, they got 2/3 of their target, but you know, I personally thought that target was very ambitious. And that money is going into infrastructure projects at Ibrox, and also I think they're opening some form of museum for fans to visit, so that there will be a genuine legacy on the back of this investment.
It's great. I mean, it's interesting. I'm sure Rangers would rather have met their target, but in terms of PR, they kind of have, really, because they've given smaller investors the chance to have at least some notional ownership of the club, and that's a brilliant thing, I think.
Yes, I would encourage more clubs to give people the opportunity. I can understand why some people aren't that keen, but it does allow fans more of a voice. It's our investment is emotional, but if it can be financial as well, there's no downside to that.
And the owner of Hibs has made quite the radical suggestion, Kieran.
Yes, it's always good to have somebody connected to a football club who's called Ron, because I think that is textbook, isn't it? Yeah, that's either a manager or the chairman. This is Ron Gordon, the chairman of Hibs, Hibernian. At present in Scottish football, there are four divisions. There are 42 clubs. And he said, knock that on the head, let's slim it down to 24 clubs. And the money generated from the SPFL should be split between those 24, and that would ensure that, you know, potentially all of those 24 clubs could go full time. He thinks that 42 clubs in a country with a population of over 5 million is spreading the goodness. But the money which is going into the bottom divisions is very modest. If you finish bottom of League Two, and these are the figures in a pre-COVID year, you would have made £45,000. So, you know, for Hibernian, getting an extra £45,000 isn't going to make a huge amount of moving the dial. Whether that will succeed is open to debate, but I think it will certainly start a debate. And the changes to Scottish football are something which we do see on a regular basis, because the clubs are rarely in agreement with one another. You can certainly see why the clubs in the lower two divisions would be against this. Could there be enough interest in the top two? We'd have to wait and see.
And in the meantime, Ron Gordon will be anxiously awaiting the draw for the Scottish FA Cup in the hope that they don't get an away trip to one of the smaller clubs, because that'd be quite a tasty reception, wouldn't it?
Yes, yeah, I'd be very careful before eating a pie at lunchtime if I was you, Ron.
Now, we've got this brilliant interview coming up, very passionate interview, /therapy session. But two international stories before that. Mikel Antonio, who almost out of nowhere in the last couple of years has become just a brilliant, rampaging, old-fashioned centre-forward, will probably make his debut for Jamaica this weekend at the age of 31. He's been in England squads before, Kieran, and he could have tried to force his way into the England squad. Will he be financially worse off playing for Jamaica than he might have been playing for England?
I don't think he'll be worse off, because, remember, England players normally donate their match fees to charity. Right. So he wouldn't have earned anything directly. Potentially, in terms of England having a greater chance of qualifying for the Qatar 2022 World Cup, and the players' pool in terms of the money they make from endorsements and intellectual property, I suspect that may have been bigger for England than Jamaica. But I suspect Mikel Antonio, who, again, I think is a fantastic player. I mean, I used to enjoy him when he played at Forest, he's a delight to watch. He might take the view, at his age, he's got one chance of getting to play in a World Cup. Gareth Southgate isn't noted for bringing in more senior players. He prefers younger players. And there's quite a queue. Harry Kane is going to be our number one striker. We've then got Greenwood, Rashford, Sterling, and so on, all of whom are established either at their clubs or as internationals. He's probably taken this as an approach that, A, it gives him the opportunity to represent his country, as far as he's concerned, and that if the reggae boys are successful, then he could be playing in the World Cup next winter, which would, footballers are still dreamers themselves, and this would be a fantastic achievement for him.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Ally's Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yeah, I'm not sure how we are meant to pronounce it, but I want everybody from now on to pronounce it Qatar, as you just did, because I think that would really annoy them, and also it will give a little tiny bit of levity to a World Cup that shouldn't be taking place in Qatar. I'm going to write to the BBC and encourage them to say Qatar as well. I call you childish, Kieran, and then I'm laughing my head off at the idea of being called Qatar. Closer to home and closer to our family homes, our generations of family homes on at least one side, the Football Association of Ireland is to pay the men and women's team equal amounts, which is very good news, isn't it?
Yes, this is a progressive step. I think New Zealand were the first country to do this. If anybody's familiar with the history of the Republic of Ireland women's team, they have been treated fairly appallingly historically. Yeah. You know, senior players having to transfer their tracksuits across to the junior teams, having to get changed in airport toilets. It's scandalous.
They threatened to strike, didn't they, in 2017?
They did indeed.
Because of the way they were being treated, yeah.
I think the men were on €2,500 and the women were on €500. So they're now being paid the same. Now, whether there's some sort of compromise in terms of that or whether the women have been moved up to the men's fee, I'm not sure. I mean, if anybody's ever read Champagne Football, the FAI's history under charismatic, I think, is the politest word of describing him, John Delaney. The finances of Irish football have taken quite a big hit in recent times, and producer Guy will be mopping his brow with relief. I use that particular word because I did have quite a large number of alternatives.
I could hear the Rolodex whirring through your head, Kieran. Producer Guy will be mopping his barrel of relief, but only after he's been through the thesaurus several times to make sure that right at the end of charismatic there isn't another meaning for that word. Maybe it's Gaelic for wrong'un. Who knows? Irish. And I don't say Gaelic. I mean, Irish. Maybe it's Irish for wrong'un. Now he is worried now. Poor guy. Even when we start off well-meaning, we end up upsetting him. Well, it's all right. He can fan himself with a bunch of fivers. He's fine.
Fivers? Come on, we can't produce a guy here.
Sorry.
He's a big notes man.
Yeah. But is it? I mean, you mentioned New Zealand. What a lovely country that is. First country, of course, to give women the vote. But this is a progressive move, Kieran, but it also highlights the fact that there are still countries that are paying their men and women's teams different amounts in 2021.
Yes. You can understand it, I think, at club football level, because ultimately, if you are looking at a business, it's your revenue that drives costs. It's the money that comes in which allows you to pay the money going out. And men's football generates more money than women's. But we have seen certainly an increase in the pay in the WSL. On an international level, if you are representing your country, I can't see much of an excuse, especially that given that most men's teams are professional, as are the women's team. And the key point is that you've achieved a standard which allows you to represent your country. There shouldn't be a need to distinguish in terms of pay.
Interview time, Kieran. And generally, you only hear the words hostile takeover in relation to multi-million pound industries, and you don't really care. But when it came to Rochdale, people did care, and they acted, and they won. And you spoke to Colin Kavanagh from Rochdale Supporters Trust to hear more details.
Colin, thanks so much for agreeing to come on the show. A quiet summer at the Dale?
Yeah. Usual story at Rochdale. Nothing happens whatsoever. And then it's just been chaos for the past 4 months.
Okay. When exactly did you start to get an inkling that there was something brewing with regards to the ownership and control of the club?
Over the past two seasons, the club board have been very honest with us that they've been looking to attract an investor to the football club. We've disagreed with that, but they've always been very clear in saying that's what they were looking to do. And they spoke to a number of people during that time. We met with somebody early on in the year who was a preferred bidder for the club. Met with him, said he said all the right things, was really we were quite pleased, despite not being what we wanted. We were pleased with what we heard from him. We expressed our concerns. And then we signed an NDA with him. And after that point there, we had radio silence. Our meeting was cancelled about an hour's notice. We had emails ignored from over there. And eventually he withdrew rather than state where his money was coming from. So this has been knocking around for quite some time. We had the EGM, and I know you covered our EGM earlier on this year, where we had two directors removed from the board of directors. And then we found ourselves with a new board in place. We had local people appointed to the board, good people who were saying all the right things. We had the CEO was removed from his position, which went down very well amongst the fan base. And then we found ourselves, despite having just been relegated, despite our manager walking out 3 days into pre-season, the mood among the fan base was fantastic. Everyone was really, really pleased with the new board. Everything was looking great. And then about a week later, there was whispers going around saying that somebody was looking to buy up shareholdings. Now, one thing we've got at Rochdale is we're not like most of the clubs, and I don't know how many other clubs we are actually like. We don't have an owner at Rochdale Football Club. We've got about 330 shareholders, and it's spread very evenly throughout these shareholders. Perhaps the fact it's Rochdale is the home of the cooperative, but the yep. club was built that way, and it's worked very well for us over that time. One thing I keep sort of saying, you look around Greater Manchester, with the exception of City and United, who are slightly on a different planet to us, but we're the only club in Greater Manchester who's not been in administration at any stage, because we see that that model works for us. But we did get an inkling that there was somebody going around, a fellow called Alexander Jarvis, was emailing shareholders looking to buy their shares and looking to pay quite a heavy penny for these shares. I think he was offering up to begin with three times what was considered to be their market value. This was on behalf of two fellows called Andrew Curran and Darrell Rose. And this baby caught us all out of the blue because, as I said, we'd had the changes at the club, we had the change in the boardroom, and everyone was quite happy. So it did catch us on the hop to an extent.
I can imagine. I mean, did you ever have any meetings with these people from Moreton House Management or Alex Jarvis? You know, did they come to the club, or did they get in contact with the trust and try to set out their position? Or was it you were just hearing that there was this ongoing attempt to build up a shareholding? Because I think in the end they ended up with around about 40% of the shares in total. Is that right?
Yeah. What happened was once there was an email leaked that it was a shareholder received this email. And that was posted in our forum. And we were looking at there. So the first thing we did is we contacted Jarvis and we basically sort of said, and we were very nice about the whole thing. We're sort of saying, look, we are aware you've been buying shareholding. We've heard these whispers. We believe it's on the behalf of Andrew Cohen and Darrell Rose. Is it possible for us to meet with them so we can express our concerns and find out what his plans are for the club? So a meeting was arranged basically very quickly from that. This was over the start of July, and we met with him in a local pub on the 6th of July. We expressed our concerns, and the concerns we expressed were basically that we would have to any potential investor, all the sort of things that we consider makes Rochdale a very unique club and has worked well for us over these years. That's what we put on the table. We've heard all the horror stories in football, and obviously we've got friends of ours who are Bury supporters. Bury's only 5 miles down the road from here.
Yeah.
So we lived that with them. We saw what was going on day after day after day. We saw the issues that was happening. And it basically puts us on red alert from the start. But we didn't approach Curran in a hostile manner. It was a case at that time, the noises we were hearing was it was inevitable that they would get over 50% of the shares. So it was a matter of time. Before they do acquire the club. So it was a case of, do we work with them? Do we work against them? And the decision at that point there was, well, let's work with them, because if we're working outside from them, there's not a great deal we can do. So we met with them. All the concerns that we had, we started doing our digging, trying to find out as much about, because we're talking two people involved. Andrew Curran comes from Dagenham. Darrell Rose comes from Worksop. Neither of them have got any connection whatsoever with the football club, with the town. And in the greatest respect, we haven't had a big queue of millionaires looking to come in and take over the club over these years. Yes. We've just been little old Rochdale. We've gone about our business and we've just happily got on with it. So again, we expressed all these concerns. He told us what he's come and met with us alongside Alexander Jarvis. And he said, look, my plans for the club, I don't want to get involved on a day-to-day basis. He says, I've met the board. The board are great. I'm happy to stick with them. He says, I just want to go somewhere to watch the football with me mates. have a few beers, and I'll bring my Rottweiler to watch matches, which is, I don't
strange.
Think the Championship had a similar conversation when Abramovich bought into them to put it mildly. So yeah, it was a little bit offbeat. It wasn't what we were expecting, but we thought, well, this is him. Perhaps he's a little bit of a character. Who knows? What had been a big concern at this stage was that when we tried doing our digging on him, we couldn't find anything whatsoever. There was involvement in a roofing company, but that was about it. And in my experience, you don't get people who've got the wealth to buy a football club, the wealth to buy a £300,000 Rolls Royce, the wealth to have a £1 million house, and then leaving no footprint whatsoever. Perhaps I'm being a little bit paranoid in my old age, but it just doesn't add up that way. I know if I was to search my own name on Google or search most, you'd find these days you find half a dozen things at least about any individual, and there was nothing coming back over somebody who's got enough wealth to buy a football club. So that was a concern. But we met with him. He told us on the night he had 44% of the shares in the football club. He said he'd provided proof of funding to the EFL. And we discussed his plans for the club. We told him he had to meet with the supporters. So we put a brief statement on our website the very next day saying, look, yeah, we met with this potential investor. This is what he's had to say. He said he's bought these shares. He said he's provided proof of funds to the EFL. And then we got contacted by the EFL the day after.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and they said, no, he hasn't. He said he cannot state that he's bought these shares because any shareholding has to be approved by the EFL.
Yeah.
We've since learned that there's been no share transfer forms presented to the club whatsoever. So from the club's perspective, they could turn around and say he doesn't own a single share in this football club at this moment in time. So the EFL asked us to remove that. The EFL also stated that they'd received no proof of funding, which was something of a surprise to us. So we contacted EFL, just said, look, are you absolutely 100% sure on this? And they said, yeah, we have got no evidence of any funding being provided, any proof of funding being provided to us at any stage. At that point there, it was the Spidey tingles was going over the top at that point there. And we thought, right, well, so we put a statement out and said, look, contrary to what we said, the EFL have told us this. At this moment in time, we contacted Alexander Jarvis and we're open with him and said, look, this is what we've been told. Until we've had any more details confirming this in the EFL, that will remain our stance. So at that point there, I think we went down to B&Q and bought about 24 spades and we started getting, everybody started digging as much information on these people. And the more we found out, the more worried that we became. And we've had some absolute Trojans working for us. We've had people from the Trust doing it. We've had supporters doing it. We've had the whole fan base have rallied around trying to find out as much information as we possibly can. Because one thing which hadn't been answered at any stage is why Rochdale? If it is just a case of wanting to go and take your dog to watch the football with a few beers, well, if you live in Dagenham, there's possibly, from conference level upwards, there's possibly a dozen teams you could go and watch instead and then get a nice taxi home rather than the taxi home that it would cost from Rochdale.
Yeah. That to me, as an outsider, was one of the big issues. You know, I know Rochdale reasonably well, mainly because my favourite band of all time, the Chameleons, comes from Middleton. So I'm pretty familiar with the area. And you know, you and I, we both know the value of property in Rochdale and the location of the ground. I've been to Spotland very many times, or the Crown Oil Arena, as I should properly call it. So trying to work out the logic behind the purchase, you know, Rochdale's fan base, it would struggle, I think, to fund a Championship club. So where exactly were they trying to take the club? Did they ever explain that to you?
Not really. In our first meeting, to be honest, I was a little bit impressed with that because there's nothing worries me more is when you get some owner going into a club and starts talking about massive, oh yeah, we're going to get promoted to the Championship and then we'll knock on the door of the Premier League, because we can see through that. We've no delusions of grandeur at Rochdale. We had it last Friday. We celebrated 100 years in the EFL, and then we were going through them, people working out. Well, there's only 9 or 10 teams who survived 100 years unbroken in the EFL during that time. And then someone took that research a bit further and they said, yeah, out of those teams, there's only one team who has spent the last 100 years in the bottom two divisions of the EFL, and that's us. So we know our place in the footballing world. We're ambitious, but we are grounded. So we didn't get any of that, oh, yeah, we're going to do that. They talked about sustainability, which was a positive from our perspective. But as I said, the more digging that we did, we could see that this just wasn't right for us. This wasn't right for Rochdale. Arguably, it wasn't right for any football club, but certainly what didn't match what we wanted at Rochdale Football Club.
Yeah, I mean, I focus on the numbers, and looking at the Rochdale accounts, I would say that they're already one of the more sustainable football clubs in the EFL because they don't tend to live beyond their means. And I think the very nature of the share ownership, because it is divided and therefore you've not got any one person underwriting the losses, meant that the club always set itself sensible budgets. And yes, some years it made a loss, but other years on the back of a good cup run or a player sale, they did fine. And I always felt them to be an example of how a club could be run as you've been saying, we are Rochdale, we know where we are, we're a community club, we're a sustainable club, and it just ticks so many boxes in its current form.
Well, for me, and maybe I'm being completely naive in saying this, but for me, running a football club should be the easiest job in the world. Every club kind of knows what their income's going to be over the next 12 months. You then set your wage budget accordingly from that, and everything should take care of itself from there. If every club in the country ran that way, then there wouldn't be a single club in the country having any financial problems at all. It is when you start paying money out that you've not got, that's when the problems start kicking in.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's those clubs. I mean, we're recording this on transfer deadline day, and I've already taken about four phone calls from radio stations from saying, "Oh, we're worried that our local club's not spending enough money." I said, "Well, what money are you trying to spend?"
Yeah,
because in case people haven't noticed, we've just had 18 months of the biggest health crisis the world's ever known in many respects, and the whole country was closed down for a load of time. We're lucky to have still 92 clubs to actually physically support, and people moaning and whinging about not spending 10, 20, 30 million in the Premier League is bonkers. But I've been on the Rochdale forum on many an occasion just over the course of the summer to see how things develop. And As a fan base, again, you seem very grounded, and your main issue is that you want a club to support because, as you've rightly said, you've got friends at Bury. I remember going along to Bury Town Hall a couple of years ago and seeing grown men and women absolutely devastated. You don't want anybody to have to go through that.
No, not at all. It's such a part of everybody's life. And like I said, we know we're not the biggest club in the country, but for 2,500-3,000 people, this club's their world.
I saw one of your fans, didn't he? Who'd raised all that money throughout his life, and then effectively he was when he sadly passed away, his estate effectively went to the club, and that's just so touching that the club meant so much to him. And I think it's a great example of what football can do to a local town. I mean, you mentioned the EFL on a few occasions already, and I think historically perhaps they've not covered themselves in glory with some other clubs, but as an outside observer, I think they've done a pretty good job over the course of the summer. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, once we realised that this hostile takeover wasn't for us, we attacked this in three ways. The first way we did this was to try and get as many shareholders as we can. I talked before saying that we are home with a cooperative, and we formed a cooperative of shareholders. Nothing formal, but it was just basically writing to shareholders and sort of saying, look, will you reject any advances that come from these people? And we managed to get 50.7% of the shares being standing against these people. So we had a bit of a comfort blanket there.
Yeah.
We also, all the digging that's been taking place, we've been contacting the EFL. I got to the stage that they must have been sick to death of getting emails from me because it was three or four times a week at times. And we provided them with so much information, all the digging that we've done. And to be honest, it's been frustrating at times. And EFL, we know the EFL don't have a great reputation for doing these things. And it was frustrating because we were asking the EFL, where are we up to with this? I did feel like a kid approaching Christmas Day, where I'm asking my mum and dad, what am I getting? What am I getting? What am I getting? And they're just looking at me going, just shut up and go away. But the EFL would say to us, look, we cannot provide a running commentary of how things are going, which is the right thing for them to do. There's no doubt about that. Exactly the right thing for them to do. It wasn't what we wanted to hear, but it was, they were doing this the proper way. And at times they've been guilty of not doing that according to some people. But in this case, we were very happy with that. So when the news came through a week last Saturday that the EFL announced that they were withdrawing from the process, they were withdrawing from the owners and directors test, we were delighted to say the least.
I can understand. And have you had any contact with the people from the Swindon Town Supporters Trust? Because they went through a broadly similar issue, except they have had a change of ownership because the previous owner wasn't popular with the fan base, and I think there were issues in terms of the day-to-day running there. So have they been able to sort of advise you in terms of some of the stresses and challenges that they face, which might have been useful to you?
Yeah, we spoke to the Swindon Trust, and the Swindon fan base as a whole have been absolutely fantastic with us. Every tweet we put out, they retweet and they get a message of support, so they've been brilliant. But the links between Andrew Curran and Swindon Town are massive. These aren't just two clubs who happen to be going through a bad stage at one particular time. Andrew Curran's son played for Swindon last season. Yep. He was an associate director at Swindon Town last year. So there's a massive link there between the two. It isn't, as I said, it's not just two basket case clubs. This is a connection between these two clubs down to one individual.
Intriguing. And presumably he still owns 40-odd% of the shares. Do you have any idea what's now going to happen? Because if you've got, yeah, that must make Moreton House the largest shareholder. I did see in the press release that the intention was to sell them. But if they've paid over the odds to buy the shares in the first place, I can't see anybody being willing to buy them at the price that was paid for them by Moreton House itself.
Well, we're in a position of absolute limbo at this moment in time. At this moment in time, they still do not own a single share in the football club. They've done the deals, they've paid the money, so they've got the power of attorney over these shares, but they haven't presented a single share transfer form to the club. So they're sat on 42% of the shares, 43% or something around that area, and we don't know what their intentions are going to be. We read the statement, we've seen their press release, which says they are looking to divest their shareholding, but we just don't know what's going to happen at this point in time. They have paid, like you said, they've paid over the odds for these shares. So I can't see anybody willingly wanting to take these shares over because they're not worth the money that they paid for. Equally, if someone was wanting to buy these shares to try and take over the club, well, Curran and Rose have created an atmosphere at the club where we really now believe in fan ownership. And I do say fan ownership rather than trust ownership. Our trust has no intentions of owning the football club or running the football club. But we've created a climate now where anybody interested is going to be investigated to the nth degree. It's not going to be a decent climate for somebody who's wanting to take over the club to come into simply because of what we've been through over the past two months. They'll be treated with suspicion straight away. The shareholders will be reluctant to sell. Curran and Rose have not been able to get to 50%, despite cases offering five times what the shares are worth. So I don't think there was opportunity for somebody to come in and take over these shares with a view of buying the club.
It does seem that there's still uncertainty involved. I mean, I think the good news is presumably following the public announcements and also the support you've had from the EFL that this particular deal is not going to go through. But I guess my concern would be, you know, if they are in a position to transfer those shares as a single block, you know, 42% is still sizable, and that certainly would have an impact upon future decisions being made at board level. So I can understand you being rightfully circumspect, but you've still got Dale to support, and you've still got matches taking place where you can get behind them. You know, up the Dale not for sale was something that was being seen on social media, and I think fans from a lot of clubs bought into that, and you know, you had the sympathy of the vast majority of fans in all clubs.
Yeah, well, as a club, we've been very stable, and we've always took an interest in what's going on with other clubs, but we always thought that it'll never happen to us. I think your average football supporter will always have that concern because, yeah, we have rivalries on the pitch, but we know there's a person in Bury just like me. There's a person in Swindon just like me. We're just football supporters at the end of the day. We just happen to support different teams, usually around where we were born in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, well, thanks so much, Colin, for coming on and expanding, you know, because this show goes out sort of on we're a non-partisan basis. We're not club affiliated as such, but hearing from clubs at all levels is absolutely essential to giving us a better understanding. And I really appreciate your comments.
Oh, thanks for having us on, Kieran. It's just we've been through a difficult couple of months, but we do believe we've got a model at Rochdale Football Club which works. We're not going to turn around and say we'll never say no to any investor going, because who knows? Someone might win the Euro Millions who lives down the road, who's got the club at heart, and we'll use that money accordingly. But unfortunately, I always say, if you're investing money into a football club and you're giving it so many, however, hundreds, thousands, millions a year, that money's always going to be finite and eventually it will stop. Yes, we have wrongs in football, but there's been plenty of good guys involved in football where the money's run out, and that's led to real problems at a football club. One of the examples I use often is Brooks Milesden at Gretna. He did so much for Gretna, but that money ran out.
Yeah.
When he had his health problems, that club was no longer getting subsidised like it was doing, and that led to the destruction of that club. And we don't want that here. Our model has shown to be working. The last 15 years has probably been the most successful 15 years in the history of the football club. So we'd quite like it staying the way which works for us at Rochdale.
Yeah. Well, as a Brighton fan, yeah, we've had quite good links with Rochdale over the years. Although you did sell us Jason Peake back in 1996, which I've never forgiven you for.
We sent him straight back. We'd have had him back at a canter.
You did have him back, actually, very quickly. Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. Thanks so much, Colin. And send our love to everybody at the Dale. And I hope you have a great season. And just watching football, you know, it's we've said on many an occasion we are looking forward to the day when this podcast stops, when there's no need for it. But it's tales such as yours, and you know what we've seen at Wigan and Bury and Macclesfield and so on that do mean, and sadly, that we need to carry on.
Yeah, well, just thanks very much, and thanks to all the Dale supporters who've helped us, and all the support from other clubs up and down the country who've offered us plenty of support over the past few weeks.
Kieran, you can tell how much it means to Colin. I say they won, Kieran, but is it as simple as that?
Well, it's not, because we think, and nobody's got the share certificates to be able to prove this one way or the other, that the people behind this hostile takeover potentially now own 42% of Rochdale. And What on earth are they going to do with those shares? You know, if they sell them to one person, you've got a pretty big elephant in the room in terms of their ability to have an influence, not control the club. If they hang on to them, it's like a bad smell in the room. I can't see them saying to the club, well, let's just go and cancel the shares, which is potentially an option, because they've paid money for them, and one can only presume that they want to get some of that money back. But as Colin himself said, that they paid over the odds. Nobody, you know, everybody thought, why on earth are they offering up to a tenner for shares which people think are probably worth no more than £2 each?
You can just hear Guy's helicopter in the background. I didn't look up, but I imagine there's a pile of white fivers coming down. You say cancel the shares, Kieran. What happened? Did they just cease to exist, those shares then? And do the rest of the shares then sort of spread out to become 100% of the shares? What's that process?
They are X shares. They will have ceased to be. They will no longer be in existence. So therefore, the individual shareholders who have the remaining shares, if you might have owned 1%, now you'll own almost 2% in terms of the total shares of Rochdale. So that's conceptually feasible. I don't know how bad the feeling is between these potential owners, whether they're licking their wounds or whether they're just saying, well, you know, it was an interesting experiment. We're going to now completely remove ourselves from the club, and good luck to the people that we bought the shares from. But we want no involvement at all. Mm.
You couldn't remember the rest of the Monty Python sketch there, could you?
I know, yes. He's bereft. He's gone to meet his mater. He's pushing up the daisies.
Thank you for listening, everybody. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to our always free-to-air podcast, and that would be very kind of you, and you can do so by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. Our next pod on Monday is our regular weekly questions pod. That's a tautology, probably, regular weekly, I don't know. But if you have any questions for us, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. That's questions on any aspect of football finance at whatever level, at whatever continent. In the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary Monty Python style farewell.
Thanks again for your feedback and comments, folks. So you do keep us on our toes. You are very very swift to identify when we've made the occasional boo boo, as Yogi Bear used to say. but if you're enjoying the show, you could give us some financial support via Patreon for as little as £1 a month, but you don't have to do that. If you just want to get some good karma, just go to that Apple purple icon for the podcasts, and if you could give us a nice 5-star review, you can say whatever you want, and believe me, some of you certainly do. But other than that, thanks again for your support, and we'll see you soon on Monday.
And I can guarantee there won't be any other podcast in the world that has mentioned Yogi Bear and Doris Stokes. Even if there's a podcast at the moment about bears and psychics, I doubt very much whether they would even mention Yogi Bear and Doris Stokes. We need to up our game, reference-wise, Kieran.
You're saying I'm not down with the kids?
I'm not excluding myself from that. It's just I'm really as far as like Yogi Bear is much funnier than Monty Python, as far as I'm concerned. I might have to go and find some old Yogi Bear now. Anyway, so yes, so smarter than the average podcast, boo boo. That's really made me chuckle. Tom Stokes, Jeanette Charles, and Yogi Bear in the same podcast.
No wonder we can't get, people to buy us out. The Price of Football.